Welcome, everyone, to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center, and Damon Linker of The Week. We are delighted to welcome back this week as our special guest, A.B. Stoddard, Associate Editor and Columnist at Real Clear Politics. Thank you, one and all. Well, it is July 30th. Today is the day that John Lewis, an American hero, is being laid to rest, had a funeral today. He was eulogized by three former American presidents. And I think it's worth pausing to say that that America, where a civil rights hero can be honored by Democrats and Republicans alike, is still with us. And so, worth noting. Now, on to the latest tweet from the president and the state of the Republican Party. The president tweeted today, with universal mail-in voting, well, anyway, I'm not going to read the whole thing. He said he's looking at delaying the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote. Linda, didn't Joe Biden say something back in April? Like, mark my words, I think he's going to try to kick back the election.
I think he did. But, we all sort of dismissed it at the time, right? And I do think it's a serious matter that he clearly does not have the authority to do so. It would take an act of Congress. The Constitution mandates when the election will take place. The date was actually set by law. And that would have to be a congressional action to change it. There are really two schools of thought on this. One is that the president issued that tweet very shortly after the very dire numbers came out that showed almost a 10% drop in GDP that would annualize to about a 30-some percent drop in GDP, which is clearly very, very bad news for the present. And, of course, we have the coronavirus with numbers spiking and deaths rising over the last couple of weeks. And so some people think, well, he just threw that out there so that, like trying to distract a bothersome dog, you throw a ball and everybody goes running to, the dog was running to catch it. And that's what he's hoping will happen with the press. On the other hand, it is very serious because there are a huge number of people who listen to this president and who will be looking for a reason to claim that if he does not win re-election, that the election itself was illegitimate. And that is feeding right into this. And this is very, very serious. And I think it is something we have to be very concerned about.
AB, it is not the first time that the president has implied that the election was going to be stolen or in some other fashion illegitimate, right?
Right. He has been working on this narrative for months now. Sometimes it comes in a burst of tweets about mail-in voting, being fraudulent and rigged and even subject to, interference from foreign powers, and this is going to be the most, fraudulent election. And then Republicans hope that he'll stop and move on to something else, and that he heard on Fox News or about a, monument somewhere, and they don't have to say anything about it. Today, he went really, to the danger zone where everyone had to comment and say, of course, the election will be held on November 3rd, and it's not within his power to change it. And even as Senator Cornyn did, to suggest what you're talking about, which is to use it as a, a distraction away from other news and make everyone run down the rabbit hole to follow it. But this is a real narrative that's going to afford him the victimhood story, the end where he is sent into exile, boohooing all the way that it was unfair, and the Biden mail-in ballots that came in after election night, when he tells us, and he will, that he knows, he has it on good authority that he won. And any ballots that come in for Biden after that, he will discredit. This is going to be, you know, we use the term constitutional crisis. We've used it a lot since February of 2017. But this will really be a nightmare for this country. And it's clear that Republicans now know, because of the many times he said stuff like this, that that's what he intends to do. He's not being subtle about it. And they, again, refuse to say, we're in the middle of a pandemic. Elections are local. Everyone can go to their, you know, election officials in their locality, in their states, find out how they can vote, how there can be a free and fair election, and how your vote can be counted, and you can get through all the hurdles that you need to get your absentee ballot counted, no matter what hurdles have been in place, put in place by legislatures or lawsuits in your state. And it's all good. No one's reassuring us. No one's saying it's all going to turn out fine. They just said today, oh, no, it won't be moved. We've gotten through this before in the Civil War. So I think that's the part that's really terrifying, is that no one is trying to back him off of his escape story and the fact that he is going to call a President Biden, should he prevail, Joe Biden prevail on election night, an illegitimate president.
Well, Bill, AB is right. They're not saying, here's what we need to do to ensure a free and fair election, even under these extraordinary circumstances. But it is notable, isn't it, that Mitch McConnell, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and a number of other officials in the Republican Party did push back today and said, nope, the election is going to take place on November 3rd.
I was pleased to see that. And I was especially pleased to see it happen so quickly. And this, I think, points us in the direction of what will be the most critical variable on November 3rd and November 4th and November 5th. It is clear that there will be an unprecedented share of ballots cast by mail this year. That means that the odds of a difference between what appears to be the case on election night and what turns out to be the case 1 or 2 or 3 days later, or even longer, will be greater than ever. And the danger is that in key states, the president will be narrowly ahead based on ballots cast in person on election night. And then by 2 or 3 days later, his narrow victory will have turned into a loss. What will happen then? And unfortunately, I think I made this point briefly last week, there are a number of different scenarios that would really gum things up between Election Day and January 20th. And legal scholars and voting experts are busy working through these scenarios. But the most dangerous one is that states wholly controlled by Republicans would create alternate slates of electors, which the constitutional language does not forbid. And then you would have the Electoral College confronted with competing slates of electors.
Damon, two-part question for you. One, does Trump's tweet signal kind of desperation and look weak? And two, isn't it a bit maddening that having seen this problem months ago, people like Senator Amy Klobuchar and others proposed huge federal spending to aid the states in preparing for mail-in voting, and Republicans opposed it because they don't want more people to vote.
Right, exactly. Emma, on the first question, yeah, it is a sign of desperation. He, you know, Trump obsessively reads the polls. He knows that he's behind pretty much everywhere. I mean, when you go to Real Clear Politics, where they do a kind of aggregate of polling, you can see the list of all the polls over the last couple of months, and a very long list. It's dozens long. And on the right-hand column, if Trump is up in that poll, it's red. And if Biden's up, it's blue. The entire column is blue. There isn't a single poll where Trump is beating Biden. And if you look back at RealClearPolitics' line graph, you see that, yeah, it's narrowed a little at times. It hasn't lately, but it is two parallel lines that never come close to really meeting. So Biden is clearly winning, and Trump knows it. So yes, is he desperate? He sure is. The thing that no one has mentioned yet, though, that worries me on top of everything else is that I think the rationale isn't that he actually is proposing that he would do this, delay the election, but that by saying it, he's laying down a marker so that if the day or so or several days after November 3rd is a kind of mess, where scenarios like what Bill laid out are unfolding, where states that the first were narrowly Trump are now starting to tip to Biden, and it's because of mail-in ballots, and it's a kind of chaos where maybe six states are really close and the lawyers are descending and they're fighting. It's like 2000 in Florida, but times six. If that's happening, Trump can then add to his own case with his voters by saying, see, I told you it was going to be a mess, and you people all said, oh, no, we'll handle it, and now look what's happening. I'm right again, and you corrupt establishmentarians on both sides were against what I said, and that shows even more why I was right and I should stay right where I am. So there's always a kind of populist angle to what Trump is doing, and he's laying down markers, I think, that could be quite dangerous in the right circumstance, which I think means, I mean, to your second question, I don't really have much to say about it, then yeah, it really is ridiculous that, you know, not only can we not fight a pandemic efficiently and effectively, not only can we figure out how to pass another round of stimulus to keep the economy moving, but we can't even figure out how to ramp up mail-in voting for the middle of the biggest pandemic in 100 years. And it is largely because the Republicans sort of didn't want to go along with it, because I think the White House was screaming at them saying, don't do this. We don't want to make it easier for people to vote, because too many of the people who would be able to vote would vote for Biden.
Yes. All right. Now, as I introduce the next subject, I know that all of you are going to, you know, you're going to roll your eyes and you're going to say, what can we even say about this? But I think it's important to get the lay of the land in terms of what is happening in American politics. Our colleague Charlie Sykes declared earlier this week, that we have now entered the demon sperm era of the Trump presidency. We had this week the president tweet out or endorse the comments of a physician that he saw online, who said that hydroxychloroquine was an outright cure for COVID, and her comments and those of other doctors were supported by conservative Tea Party patriots. And it ran on Breitbart News. And then, of course, people looked her up. Oh, and so Trump said that she was very impressive. And then it turns out that she believes that real life ailments like fibroid tumors and cysts stem from demonic sperm after people have sex with demons in their dreams. Right. So, go ahead, Bill. You're laughing. And by the way, Louis Gohmert, you might want to comment on this. Louis Gohmert, congressman from Texas, has tested positive for coronavirus after declining very flagrantly to wear a mask. And not only that, but refusing to, ridiculing people on his staff who wore masks.
Can I just interrupt and
yeah,
add to that?
Go for it.
Herman Cain, who probably contracted COVID when he was in Tulsa at the president's rally, has now died of COVID as well. So, you know, this right. is not so much a laughing matter. It's pretty serious.
It is very serious. But we are not a serious people.
Not anymore.
No. So, Bill, do you want to weigh in on the Louis Gohmerts of the world? Look, one of the things, Politico had a piece, you know, about how Republican, here I am asking you to condemn Republicans, which is really kind of, well, I guess Linda and I should do that work. But Republican members are, many of them, according to Politico, are demanding that their staff show up in person and are discouraging the use of masks and other health precautions. And now they're beginning to test positive, and that's the level of the party. Who wants to comment?
I would love to jump in and just say I am really I tend to really bristle when, you know, there are just overreaching statements made about, you know, an entire party does this or believes that. Yep. But if you, even a few months ago, let's say the weekend of March 14th when we locked down, had come up with some kind of crazy late night skit with all these details about how much Republicans were going to work so hard to deny science, none of us would have believed it. And I'll finish there.
Nope, that's absolutely right. Now, AB, you had a piece where you basically said there has to be, you know, there have to be two parties, and one of them has, you know, be better if one of them were sane. But none of the people currently in the Republican Party can save it. So you're hoping it will be some sort of an outsider. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I know we're all engaged in a vigorous, it's not even really a debate, it's sort of a discussion about what the Republican Party is going to do to itself should Trump go down. And I'm actually more concerned even if he wins the second term, what's going to happen. Because I think that will be a permission for a rampaging crime spree and all sorts of democracy torching that we've not even begun to imagine in our worst demon sperm dreams. So I do think that there's an important question about what radicalized party does to the other party. And we're all concerned, right, that as one party becomes more extreme, it makes the other more extreme. And I do think that I'm not weighing in this piece about all the senators losing their elections so that the Senate loses their majority, the Republicans. It's really about the senators and the other ones outside the Senate who intend to try to take Trump's place. So that's Pompeo, Pence, DeSantis, and then all of these senators on the Republican side who dream that they are the next successor, that they will woo Ivanka and DJ TJ and Eric and Trump Papa and everybody and just be the rightful heir to both the base and become the anointed nominee in 2024, Nikki Haley included. And it's those people I'm saying really cannot be, they're not fit to reform the party. They're not interested in reforming the party. They're not looking for a sane party. They surrendered the party. And I do believe that the only way the Republican Party can be saved is from the outside. Someone coming in and placing the emphasis on competence and integrity and governance and problem solving and really talking about the things that I believe the people running for 2024 are not going to be interested in talking about. And I know that's probably, you know, delusional on my part, but I do think if it was not Mike Bloomberg and not Oprah and not, you know, Mark Cuban, that the right business person could be out there and could make sense to a lot of disaffected voters who are going to vote for Biden this time, but then will be worried about the Democratic Party come 2022.
First of all, I thought it was a terrific column, AB, but let me quibble with you a little bit about looking for another business leader to come in and rescue the United States. I've spent much of my professional career in the corporate world, in addition to being involved in public policy. And I will tell you, I've known lots and lots of CEOs. They are very smart. They are very talented. And most of them would make terrible presidents. the idea of governing, if you've been in the position of being a CEO, the only persons you have to you know, basically listen to if you're a CEO is your board of directors, who are beholden to the shareholders of the company. It is not the kind of environment that necessarily produces people who I think would be good at governing in a pluralist democracy like ours, who are used to working as co-equals with Congress, to respecting the views of the judiciary. So I don't think that's where we ought to be looking. I agree with you that the kind of people who have sold their souls to this Trumpist cabal that has taken over the Republican Party are not the people that we should hope, you know, take over Republicans in the future. But I do think there are governors out there and good Republican governors. I mean, there are a number of them. Larry Hogan would be top of my list. He happens to be my governor. But people who know how to govern, who know how to be an executive in the government as opposed to being executive in a corporate structure, and that's where we need to be looking, but not to some, you know, shining knight in shining armor, you know, racing in from the corporate world. I think that's exactly the wrong place to look for.
Yeah, but I have to say, Linda, as much as I agree that a governor is often a good choice, the voters are the problem. The voters want an entertainer. They want someone who presses all of their cultural buttons and lets them revel in hatred of others. And as long as that's the case, a nice, solid, respectable governor is not going to appeal to them. Now, maybe, and we'll see, maybe if Trump loses by a tremendous thundering landslide, maybe the appeal of the outsider and the entertainer will be diminished. But right now, I don't know. All right. But let us turn to the Democrats, because both Damon and Bill wrote this week about what they perceive to be a Democratic vulnerability, namely violence in cities like Seattle, like Portland, which is a potential weakness. Damon, why don't you start us off on this topic?
Well, I mean, my column on that subject was pretty pragmatic. I sort of gave the protesters their due, even though I am not personally very strongly committed to huge numbers of progressive reforms that all the protesters are in favor of. I favor some about policing and some aspects of law enforcement. But in general, I think that those issues were put on the public agenda within the first week or so that the protests began in late May. Since then, I don't exactly know what more good is being accomplished. There always are in places like Portland these days, a kind of a contingent of kind of permanent protesters hanging around. And then you add in lockdowns and economic anxieties and things like that, and that has led those numbers to be larger. And they've sort of lingered around, and then Trump sent in his kind of federal officers to mess things up a little bit and provoke more protesters to come out. So all of this keeps going on, but it's not clear to me what else good can come from this at this point. What you hear when you listen to interviews with people on the street doing the protesting in the last week or so, and you ask them, well, what are you hoping to accomplish? The answer is usually something like, well, we want those federal people, those stormtroopers to go away. But of course, the thing that would make them go away is if the protests stopped. So if they truly wanted that to end, they could just go home. But they don't seem to want to do that. And so my sense is that we've certainly reached the point by now where there's not really much good politically, either on policy or in terms of Joe Biden's prospects for election by this continuing to drag on. It was a kind of pragmatic statement of, okay, nice job, well done, I'm with you in spirit, but time to pack it up and let's stop with the mayhem, you know, because there are these events happening around the country that keep surging up. There was a shooting in Austin where a protester was killed, in Aurora, Colorado. A Jeep kind of sped through a protest area and someone among the protesters fired a gun at the car and it missed and hit other protesters and injured or killed them. I don't remember which, if it was fatal, but there's those. And in Louisville, Kentucky, there were militias, armed militias of the left and right within a few hundred feet of each other. These are all events, plus all the Portland and Seattle mayhem. It's a kind of tinderbox that could easily explode, get far worse, and then could really start to blow back and hurt the Democratic nominee.
Right. So one of the things that people have been saying is, well, this mayhem is all happening on Donald Trump's watch. Therefore, it's going to hurt him. It's not going to hurt Biden. But Bill, you don't agree with that, right?
Well, I don't know how much it's going to hurt because I don't know how easy it will be to divert public attention from, you know, the threat to life and livelihood that the current situation poses.
You mean the virus?
Exactly. And the virus and the economic consequences of the virus.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is not 1968. But I think it's never a good idea for a politician to leave a flank exposed. And Biden back in June made a very crisp distinction between peaceful protest and violent disorder. For reasons that I don't entirely understand, although he did sort of do that in response to a question a couple of days ago, he hasn't really been forthright about it this time. And I think he should be. Among other things, African-American leaders, starting with Portland but not ending there, are beginning to worry that white radicals are hijacking their protest. And one of them in Portland advised his people to go home, you know, on the grounds that this confusion was playing into the, you know, the hands of the enemies of reform. I would also say that we would probably be in a different place if we had found a way last month to get to yes on a policing reform bill. And the fact that we didn't has created fears in the African-American community that once again, there will have been a surge of interest and protest and concern. And at the end of the day, nothing will change. So there's a lot of work to do on these fronts. But in the meantime, Biden ought to say peaceful protest, yes, violence and disorder, no. And even if nobody is dying in the federal courthouse in Portland, that demonstrators ought not to be trying on a nightly basis to burn it down.
Right. We made the point on this podcast a few times, I think, that that Biden resisted some of the more extreme reform proposals, including the defund the police. Not that that really will deter the Trump campaign from suggesting the opposite. So we have a clip of a Trump campaign ad that's currently running in a lot of swing states. Maybe we can just play that and get a flavor of it.
You have reached the 911 police emergency line. Due to defunding of the police department, we're sorry, but no one is here to take your call. If you're calling to report a rape, please press 1. To report a murder, press 2. To report a home invasion, press 3. For all other crimes, leave your name and number, and someone will get back to you. Our estimated wait time is currently 5 days. Goodbye.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
Right. And then scrolling along in the video is, you know, that Biden's allies, it says, want to defund the police. So the strong suggestion there is that Biden would do this. So Damon, do you agree with Bill that it wouldn't hurt Biden at all and might even help if he were to make some kind of very clear statement about protest good, violence bad?
I think he absolutely should do more of it. He did issue a statement somewhat like that yesterday, where he said, you know, arsonists and people, you know, setting fires and you know, hurling projectiles at the courthouse in Portland should stop, while supporting kind of the more justice flavored ends of the protest movement in general. So he did a little bit, and I would like to hear him do more. And I actually have a fair amount of faith that he will. His campaign, you know, you can fault them here and there, but on the whole, I've been really struck at how sure-footed it has been on this. They really never take the Trumpian bait. They're doing nothing themselves. Now, Trump can do everything he wants to try to engage in guilt by association. Well, he's a Democrat, he's a liberal, everyone to the left of center is really just Antifa underneath. But, and there will undoubtedly be some Republicans who will buy that, but I don't envision an awful lot of independent swing voters will be persuaded by that, because it's Joe Biden. Everybody knows Joe Biden, and he spent 9 months in the primaries and debates being hit from the left for being insufficiently woke. So he's pretty much insulated against that, I think, unless he made a misstep, but I don't see it happening.
Okay, so let's talk about possible missteps, because Biden has, I guess, three big things that he has to get done between now and November 3rd. The first is choosing a vice president. Then there's putting on a somewhat decent convention. And the third is performing decently in debates. So regarding the VP pick, which we think could be coming as soon as next week, we've discussed this a little bit, but I want to ask all of you, what would for you represent a mistake? Linda, what do you think about that?
Well, it's hard to know. I think it could play various ways. I mean, I was very unhappy that he boxed himself in by saying that it had to be a woman, and now he's pretty much boxed himself in, or others have boxed him in, to trying to make sure he picks a woman of color. And I think that was really the wrong way to go. I think if he were to pick somebody like Elizabeth Warren, I think that would be a huge mistake. It would make it very difficult for people like myself and those of us who still want to think we're conservative to vote for him. On the other hand, if he were to pick my, you know, favorite, which would be Tammy Duckworth, he might lose some goodwill among the African American community. So I think he's really put himself in a bind here, and I think he's going to have to pick very carefully. And I think it is going to probably be an African American woman. And I guess if I were to try to handicap this, I would say that Kamala Harris is certainly up there, but so is Val Demings, and so is Karen Bass. I think those are the three safest of his picks.
AB, some people say Biden was the choice of the African-American community in the primaries, and he beat other African-American candidates because he had such strong support from them. So he doesn't really need to worry about shoring up that constituency. That's one argument. The others say, on the other hand, people say, well, no, the fact is the African-American community feels that it is owed a pick because they put him over the top. What do you have a view about that? And what do you think would be a mistake?
I'm with Linda. I think that an Elizabeth Warren pick is probably the worst mistake, because she's so ambitious, and she would, while electrifying a good portion of the progressive or left wing of the party, would turn away former Republicans and independents that Biden has thus far been able to persuade, because she would look like a president in waiting. So I wrote a piece today for Real Clear about whether or not Biden's pick is going to represent a push to the future or a pause. I'm of the mind that Biden is going to pick a pause because he wants a governing partner, and he actually doesn't want someone like Kamala Harris to be running for president from day one. So he doesn't have a lot of good choices. I agree, and many Democrats privately have told me they agree that getting boxed into a Black woman pick limits his options. And I don't know what those conversations with Jim Clyburn and other, you know, hugely influential advisors have led Biden to believe. Maybe he'll stun us and pick a white woman. But I think that going with someone who wants to be the next nominee of the party becomes a huge distraction, because he wants to have someone sort of apprenticing under him that could become president and can do the job as soon as possible, but he doesn't want them to be under pressure from the party every day to take this position that Ilhan Omar, you know, says on Twitter is important to come out and support, and on and on. So I think that there are a lot of, they're almost all problematic. None of them are perfect. I could still see Tammy Baldwin. I mean, I could see us being stunned. I would probably have to pick Warren as the worst pick if I picked one.
So Damon, that's two votes for Warren would be the worst pick. People say Biden really likes her.
Yeah, I mean, she might be very charming and friendly in private. She's obviously highly intelligent. She knows probably more about the ins and outs of policy than anybody else. So I see the appeal. There's also the fear that because Biden does have the reputation of being more of a moderate, that he still remains vulnerable on his left flank, and that would certainly satisfy all of that. I hear all of that. I'm not sure I'd be willing to say like she's automatically the worst. I actually tend to think that the kind of the troika of lesser known African American women, Val Demings, Keisha Lance Bottom, the Atlanta's mayor, or Karen Bass, all of them, I think, are sort of the more risky together, just because none of them are quite on the national stage yet. And so they are untested. And I think, I know that there's been a lot of buzz about the Biden campaign being concerned that he not be upstaged by his running mate. And there's the fear that maybe that would happen with Kamala Harris or maybe some others, but I feared the opposite problem would happen with some of these other people where it would look like the main guy and then like some underling just kind of off on the side. So if it has to be a woman of color, I do think Kamala Harris has always been the logical choice. But, you know, I also think that, you know, there might be, Susan Rice. Susan Rice, no one has mentioned in here yet. She's never run for elective office, so she would also be risky in her own way. On the other hand, she's used to standing on a stage and speaking with authority as a major figure in a presidential administration under Obama. So I think she is someone who people should be considering in the final running as well. So I sort of lean toward Harris or Rice as the more likely and best options.
I'm not weighing in on whether or not I think it's right, but I should have added that, yes, she is under serious contention and is seen as a safe pick, Susan Rice.
So, Bill, do you think it's safe to go with someone who's never had any electoral experience whatsoever, no matter how lofty their position was in an administration?
I had my 800-word say on this topic in last week's Wall Street Journal, and the answer is absolutely not. I think there are several reasons why leaning in Susan Rice's direction, despite her gifts and strengths, would be a mistake. A zero experience in electoral competition is only one of them. Another is that it would resuscitate battles of the past. And I'm not sure that's exactly what the Biden campaign wants or should want. A third point is that Biden doesn't need help managing foreign policy. His presidential in-basket will be filled with foreign policy issues. What he needs is someone who can do for him what he did for Obama, namely serve as an effective emissary to the Congress of the United States and a negotiator on his behalf. And I think that for governance purposes, someone with serious legislative skills, someone like Karen Bass, who rose to the top of the California legislature, has been in the National Congress now for more than a decade and has risen to the top of the Congressional Black Caucus, someone whom Kevin McCarthy has called his favorite Democrat, despite the fact that that she's well to the left of Joe Biden. I think someone like that would bring something important to the ticket. I will also say that regardless of the fact that African Americans supported Biden in droves during the primaries, I think it would be quite deflationary for him to go in a different direction with his vice presidential pick. And they not only supported him, they saved his candidacy when it was on the ropes. I do think that not taking your base for granted is a very important part of a vice presidential pick. I think that Trump was smart to choose Pence. It was one of the smart decisions that he made in the summer of 2016, because it sent a clear message to the evangelicals and the other social conservatives that he wasn't going to take them for granted and that he was serious about the promises that he was making to them. So for all of those reasons, I think that someone with serious legislative experience would be a good pick. And I want to underscore my agreement with AB's central point, namely that you don't want as your vice presidential pick someone who's going to start running for president right after the midterm elections of 2022. If you're going to be a one-term president, you deserve a term and not just 2 years.
Could I just weigh in to say something about Susan Rice? Because I think it needs to be said. Susan Rice is viewed by much of the pro-Israel community as not very friendly to our greatest ally in the Middle East, Israel. In fact, Dennis Ross, I think, wrote a column a few years ago in which he said that Rice viewed Israel as more of a problem than a partner. And I think, you know, that adds to the reasons why I don't think she would be a good choice.
The African American community has reason to believe that Joe Biden owes them. I'm going to echo Bill on this, that they saved him and that it's the least he can do is to name an African American. Now, I don't like that kind of politics, where it's, you know, trading on identity and all of that. I think, you know, it's unfortunate that Biden said he would pick a woman. Not that it's bad to pick a woman. It's great to pick a woman, but it's bad to say you're going to pick a woman because then it seems like you picked the best woman instead of the best person. And similarly, when you're narrowing it down by ethnic group too. Karen Bass is, from everything I hear, very well respected and people like her, even though she's very far to the left for my tastes. But, you know, if it may be, Bill, that you say a president deserves a full term, and certainly Kamala Harris would start running immediately. I don't know that she'd even wait for the midterms if she were the pick. But, you know, one of the things that I think Biden should not do is say that he's a one-term president.
Of course not.
Yeah, yeah. Of course yeah, not. Okay.
Right.
Because he's immediately a lame duck.
Right. But my broader point is this, Mona. If you pick someone as your vice president who is clearly itching to run for president, parenthesis again, then from day one, the interests of your vice president will not be fully aligned with your own interests.
Right.
And that's not good in a White House.
No. All right. Well, I'm not sure that Tammy Duckworth, who is my sentimental favorite, I have to confess, because I love her story, the immigrant story, the woman in the military who lost her legs in combat, she's an incredibly impressive person. Also gave birth while in the Senate, and they changed the rules so that she could bring her baby onto the floor. So anyway, she's very impressive. But I guess she may be out of the running because she's not African American. So
could I just correct you though, Mona? She's not exactly an immigrant. If she were an immigrant, she would be ineligible because she was born abroad, but to an American father
and an Asian Thai mother.
Right.
Yes. That's your thank you for correcting that. That's right. But it's sort of an immigrant story all the same.
It is.
All right. But of course, you know, we're probably going to have birthers out there saying that because she was born abroad, she's
guaranteed.
Guaranteed. Right. Okay. Look, can we just say a few words before we turn to our final segment? Let's just say a few words about what the little stunt that the Congress pulled this week, dragging the leaders of big tech into a hearing so that they could be upbraided from both sides. So I should point out, Jim Sensenbrenner, the congressman from Wisconsin, Republican, was taking Mark Zuckerberg to task because he said Donald Trump Jr.'s tweets about the drug hydroxychloroquine had been unfairly deleted. And Zuckerberg was forced to say, I think you're referring to Twitter. I just found the whole thing one of the more lamentable examples of Congress misusing its authority. Look, they're beating up on big tech at a time when, well, first of all, a number of them are nothing remotely like monopolies. Second, and there are laws against that, so the Justice Department can go after them if they engage in any competitive practices. But second, we are in the midst of a terrible national trauma. The virus, the economy, is this what we need to be doing, beating up the leaders of our big tech companies, Bill Galston?
Well, Mona, I want to distinguish between the timing and theatrics of the hearing on the one hand, and on both of those points, I agree with you, and the underlying issue. I did a deep dive into the history and current status of antitrust law and enforcement a couple of years ago, and I came away with the conclusion that many of the four companies, if not all of them, have been engaged in different forms of restraint of trade, and that consumer pricing is not the only metric that we ought to be using in these cases. A lot of these companies have been using strategies of capture and strangle to deal with emerging adversaries. They make them an offer they can't refuse. They acquire the company, and then they kill the alternate technology to make sure that they don't have a serious technological competitor. And in the case of Amazon, there's clear evidence that they're using their market position in order to extract information from smaller companies that they can use, that Amazon can then use to build its own competing products. So I would not dismiss the underlying issues raised by the hearing as blithely as some people are now doing.
Well, Damon, one of the things that they're accusing Amazon of, one of its supposed sins, is that it offers its own brand of product to at a cheaper price that competes with the products that other vendors are offering on their site. That does not strike me as a problem. You know, you go into the giant supermarket and there's the Cheerios brand that's by Post or whoever makes it, General Mills. And then there's the giant brand, which is cheaper and it's called, you know, Healthy O's. There's nothing wrong with that, is there? In fact, it's good for the consumer.
Well, on that particular issue, I might agree with you, but having worked for a few years in academic publishing and dealing with Amazon from the back end in that small industry, I will say that Amazon's practices are extremely aggressive. And I don't know, as Bill does, the ins and outs of the law on these matters, but it can be faintly alarming when you see it at work. In academic book publishing these days, there are very few places to sell your books other than Amazon. And Amazon routinely lowers the number of books that they will take to hold in their warehouse. If they run out then of supply, they will drag their feet, take several weeks in order before they send out their own trucks to pick up the books. You can't even have them shipped to Amazon because they won't do it that way. They will routinely jack up the price for books as they wish. The price floats around. It's not in the control of the presses in any way. It seems to be the behavior of a company that wants to kind of beat companies into submission so that they can always place their price point at an advantage to them, even if it ends up destroying the companies along the way. And then they go about then, say, offering book contracts of their own for a Kindle edition so that eventually academic authors will go just to Amazon and publish their book directly from them and cut us out. So that's a very tiny slice of the business Amazon does. And I order plenty of Amazon products, so I understand how great they can be. And especially since the pandemic, a huge portion of our nation's commerce is being undertaken through deliveries from Amazon. And then there are all the ancillary companies like UPS and so forth that benefit from all of that commerce. So it's a very tough nut to crack. But I agree with Bill that it's not something that can be simply waved away. What I think should be waved away is the grandstanding demagoguery of a lot of what's going on in Congress and how they deal with it, not particularly informed. And the fact that the right is going in for this is particularly strange given how much the right and the populist right has benefited from the very kinds of social media oriented ventures that are represented by the people who were there yesterday. I mean, they went after Mark Zuckerberg, and I have no, like, you know, special fondness for Facebook. But if you look at the top 10 Facebook posts on any given day, most days, 9 of the 10 are from far right sources. So the very people who are most inclined to attack Zuckerberg in that hearing yesterday are the forces in the party that are benefiting the most from what Zuckerberg is doing. So there was a real air of bad faith about a lot of it, like it was all just theater, and in that sense, not that different than a lot of what's going on in Washington these days.
Yeah. AB, the Representative Jim Jordan was fairly typical, where he was whining. He said, "I'll just cut to the chase. Big tech is out to get conservatives." But Damon's right. The conservatives have made excellent use of all of these platforms.
Facebook is a huge asset to President Trump. And there's a lot of speculation on the left about this dinner that they had in October of 2019, whether or not there was, you know, they came into an implicit agreement because Mark Zuckerberg has been under heat from thousands of his own employees as sort of some kind of, you know, extension of the Trump campaign, willing to protect him by allowing all these ads that contain lies. And the Biden campaign, though continuing to purchase ads on Facebook because they're so powerful in campaigns, has circulated a petition asking people to, you know, kind of put pressure on Facebook about policing the truth, which they've thus far refused to do. I'm with Damon. I mean, I was fascinating that you went straight to Bill, because when you asked me about this, I was going to ask Bill to give us a lesson, because I know how much he's worked on this. And I remember listening to him give a presentation on it about 2 years ago. I think there's
Bill has worked on everything.
That's true. The go source.
That is not true. But let me just drop a quick footnote here. I don't often praise Tucker Carlson. But apropos of Jim Jordan, Carlson challenged Jordan on television yesterday and said, quote, Google is your second biggest campaign contributor.
Oh, that's hilarious. And I'll just quickly say, I'm with Damon that the Congress did this clearly for campaign clips, for advertisements, both sides having an interest that were different. But it wasn't a coherent argument for any kind of legislation that would have to be so bipartisan and have such a critical mass of support from both parties in order to go up against big tech that I don't think they should have another hearing like this until and unless they get to a point where they're actually ready to regulate and there's some consensus about what to do about it.
Linda, do you think they should be regulating big tech, the government?
Well, I in general don't think the government does a great job when they try to regulate in these kinds of areas. So I'm not sure I would endorse that. I think this was a big ho-hum. I think most Americans believe they have benefited greatly by the expansion of e-commerce. And I think, as you suggested, particularly now when we can't go out and do our shopping, we cannot go into the mall and buy our pairs of shoes or our shoelaces or what have you. You have to do it online. I think this was just the wrong time. And I think it looked rather silly. And I'm not sure that very many people were paying attention. I will tell you, I wasn't.
So I would say that the Congress, both sides, the Democrats and Republicans, at least with this hearing, completely missed the most important things that we all ought to be paying attention to regarding big tech and its effect on our society. And those are the algorithms that especially people like YouTube and Twitter and others use to radicalize people. That is a big worry. Josh Hawley has addressed it to a degree and not in a way that I like, but that is a serious, serious problem that the information age poses to our society. It's had the effect of extreme polarization and radicalization of us as a people. And it has made mainstream ideas that used to be on the fringe. Those are really important, far more important matters, in my judgment, than the kinds of things that the members were raising this week. But I'm sure, have many more opportunities to talk about that. Let us now go to our final segment. AB, let's start with you.
Well, I'm really going to be looking to see what a point the Democrats put on stabilizing and sustaining the post office now that the president has tweeted about delaying the election. With the Postmaster General and others making announcements about the destabilization of the post office and having to make cutbacks and stuff, this obviously is going to threaten the election. And unless and until we see a real effort by the Republicans to join with Democrats to protect their own rural voters who depend on the post office surviving, not to mention how critical it's going to be in this election. I just don't believe, particularly on top of the fact that they have not been interested in giving any money in the latest COVID relief to secure elections, that they're interested in securing the election on November 3rd.
Bill Galston.
Well, one of the few advantages of our current situation is that I have more time available to read long books. And I just finished a biography of John Maynard Keynes by Zachary Carter. And although I object to Carter's treatment of the president I worked for, Bill Clinton, it is an extraordinary exploration of the development of contemporary economics on both the left and in the center and on the right. I can't commend it too highly in that regard.
Interesting. It gets all the way to Clinton.
Well, it's, Keynes died in 1946. He was, you know, he was in effect killed by the Bretton Woods Conference, to which he gave his dying all. But then Carter goes on to tell the story of how Keynes was appropriated and transformed by American academics, starting with Paul Samuelson. Mm-hmm. And what happened? I mean, it sounded very, very much like the story of Freud's Americanization. It wasn't just a translation into English. You know, it was a recasting of Freud in the American grain. And this very similar thing happened to Keynes here, with mixed results.
Interesting. Damon.
Well, I know normally in this segment we highlight something kind of worthwhile for people to read or think about. This time I'm going to go a little different direction and actually point to a couple of Trump tweets. And Lord knows the competition for worst Trump tweet is fierce. However, I want to highlight a couple of tweets of the president's from yesterday, which is Wednesday the 29th. Little after noon, the president tweeted the following. I am happy to inform all of the people living in their suburban lifestyle dream that you will no longer be bothered or financially hurt by having low-income housing built in your neighborhood. Your housing prices will go up based on the market and crime will go down. I have rescinded the Obama-Biden AFFH rule. Enjoy. God, like the enjoy is like sad at the end, the perfect Trumpian flourish at the end. He's referring to the affirmatively furthering a fair housing rule. I just want to point out the kind of outrageousness. Again, I'm a journalist and intellectual. I like consistency, and that's probably a flaw in this age. But my goodness, this is the populist. This is the guy whose inaugural address talked about how the Republicans were now a workers' party. And he's tweeting out that basically all you suburbanites who don't want those you know, garbage poor people moving in and ruining your housing values, I'm on your side. It is really just something else. So there you go for your entertainment.
Oh, gosh, yes. What I loved about that tweet was the subtlety.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, well, at least he didn't use the N-word, which was probably...
but you sort of felt that he wanted
to. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Absolutely nothing has changed since Fred Trump in 1973 in Queens.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right.
There's a real through line here.
The person who saved him from that federal lawsuit, by the way, was Roy Cohn.
Yeah.
That's the other through line.
Yes. He wanted his Roy Cohn in the Justice Department, and he finally got one. We haven't talked about Bill Barr in a while, maybe next week. Okay. Well, my final item is also not a cheerful one, not a recommendation. I'm going to call out something I saw in the Washington Post as bad journalism. There was a story in the Post, which is an excellent newspaper and has wonderful things in general. But here's an example that wasn't so good. The story was titled Study: Wage Gap Robs Black Women in D.C. of Nearly $2 Million, unquote. Now, this was a news story based entirely on a study from the National Women's Law Center, which is a left-leaning think tank, which published a study suggesting that Black women's wages are below those of white men. But as is so common in these cases, they were not comparing apples to apples. They were comparing unlikes. And unless you make the comparison of how somebody with the same level of education and the same skills and the same number of hours worked per week, you cannot then say that there is a wage gap based on race or sex. And unfortunately, too often this happens and in news stories, and they not only did they accept sort of credulously all of the assumptions in this report, but they did not seek out a quote from anybody who might have had another point of view. All the quotes are from similarly left-leaning organizations and people, and they could have, you know, the American Enterprise Institute is right down the street. They could have picked up the phone and spoken to somebody there, and so that's just not the way to do it, folks.
Mona, right. Mona, you forgot me. You forgot me.
I'm so sorry, Linda.
That's all right. Sorry. If it wasn't such an important issue, I wouldn't make a point about it, but it is. We talked a few weeks ago when the Supreme Court handed its decision down in the DACA case that it was only a partial win, because what the Supreme Court did was it threw out the rescission of DACA that the Trump administration tried to put in place, but it threw it back to the Department of Homeland Security and said, look, you've got to follow the Administrative Procedures Act if you're going to make changes. Well, this week on Tuesday, with little fanfare and not very much attention, essentially, Chad Wolf, who is the acting secretary, gave the big middle finger to the Supreme Court, because he did, in fact, rescind once again the decision or the program. He said that he was no longer, from this day forward, were they going to be accepting any future requests from DACA, and they were going to reject all pending requests on DACA. He also said that he was going to rescind any pending and future application for advanced parole, which would allow those who are currently recipients of DACA to be able to leave the United States, for example, and travel abroad and then come back. And finally, he said that he was going to shorten the DACA renewals that the court basically said they had to continue with, and that they were going to be shortened from 2 years to 1 year, which effectively will double the cost to the DACA recipients, and is a huge rebuke to the Supreme Court for him to issue these regulations, this memorandum, and say that he is changing this program in this way, and to do it summarily as he did, is an outrageous slap at the United States Supreme Court.
Linda, I can only say that the only silver lining there is that nobody can travel anywhere anyway with an American passport right now.
That's true. That's true. Sad.
But yes. All right. Well, again, sorry that I missed you, and I'm glad you you added that. And thank you, AB. Thank you, one and all. If you have comments about this podcast, you can reach me at mcharon@eppc.org. I always look forward to getting feedback. Also, if you would be kind enough to rate us and review us and spread the word, we are getting something like 75,000 downloads per episode now. We've been going up in a straight incline, which is really encouraging and gratifying. So we appreciate all of you who are listening, and please spread the word and help us grow even more. We will be back next week. Have a good week, everyone.